During the 24 years of the occupation, Australia did build up a very close relationship with Indonesia and, in fact, at the United Nations, continually took Indonesia's side and helped it with lobbying at the UN. I happened to be there one time and see them. And I think that this was seen by the pro-independence forces in East Timor and many of their supporters in Australia as a totally unnecessary thing to do.
From villain to hero. That's how many East Timorese view Australia's stance in support of the annexation of their country by Indonesia in 1975, then its role as the lead peacekeeper following its independence vote in August 1999. When East Timor voted overwhelmingly for independence from Indonesia on August 30, 1999, armed thugs and militia were already beginning their rampage of destruction. Just 21 days later, a peacekeeping force led by Australia, called INTERFET, was there on the grounds. The guiding hand of those violent groups was hardly a secret even back then, so why would Australia want to sour its relationship with Indonesia following 24 years of support? Dr. Helen Hill is a sociologist who focuses on the issues surrounding East Timor's constant struggles for independence. This is the story of East Timor's 1999 struggle to be rid of Indonesian influence and of the tenuous relationship between its two closest neighbours. What was the rest of the world's reaction to the annexation of East Timor?
Well, of course, over the 24 years, it took different forms, but Australia was the only country to give de jure recognition to the Indonesian occupation of East Timor and to the transformation of it into its 27th province, and never changed from that. No other country did that. Even the ASEAN countries just gave a sort of block recognition that you don't interfere in the internal politics of another ASEAN member. So, of course, they went along with it. And so on the 5th of May, 1999, Portugal and Indonesia, of course, this is after Suharto was gone, and when Habibie came in and decided Timor wasn't worth spending all this money on, it was really only then that a proposition was able to be put forward for a referendum, and it took a long time.
So the May 5 agreement would allow there to be a referendum for an independence vote?
Yes, the May 5th agreement led to UNIMET being set up by the United Nations to supervise the elections. Now, many say that the fatal flaw with the May 5th agreement was that it left responsibility for security in the hands of Indonesia. Now, Indonesia wouldn't have allowed it to go ahead had it not done that, so this was something that had to be accepted. In fact, was accepted by the Timorese, although they didn't like it, of course. And many people say the election shouldn't have gone ahead because it would have been known that there was going to be violence afterwards. However, the Timorese were prepared in the leadership of the CNRT, the umbrella movement of the independence movement, were prepared to take that risk, even though they knew that there might be casualties. The outcome of the vote was, as you'll be aware, overwhelming percentage, nearly 80% voting in favour of independence. Now, the Indonesians were suffering possibly from a little bit of self-delusion. Many believed that the Timorese would vote for special autonomy, which would have meant they would have stayed within the Indonesian Republic, and were shocked to find that this was how they voted. So that, in a sense, when the vote was announced and the violence started, the real violence started almost immediately the vote was announced, there had not been a lot of planning for what would take place.
See, from the Indonesian point of view, is that, hey, we built up this country after 25 years. You may not have wanted us there, but we built roads, we built schools, we really worked on the infrastructure of this place. And now you don't want us? Well, guess what? We're going to take everything home. And, you know, they just destroyed everything. When we got there, the whole place was smoking. And if they couldn't destroy your house, they at least took your roof.
Australian soldier Chip Henris Anderson was one of the first peacekeepers to hit the ground in East Timor on September 20, 1999. In the lightning-fast deployment of nearly 3,000 Australian troops just 21 days after the independence vote, INTERFET is considered the fastest United Nations deployment in history. As Mr. Henris Anderson explains, the Australian contingent had done its own planning.
At that time, what we were doing a lot of training for was, you know, possible unrest in a country, in a nearby country, and us evacuating Australian nationals. That was a big part of our training at the time. Going in on the ground and doing the peacekeeping, well, that's the sort of bread and butter that Australian infantry forces armoured forces as well are prepared for in the course of their lives. And I think that sort of thing, like getting the Tetum language books, was a really good thing. A lot of us started practicing with it before we deployed. Our intelligence people would come and give us briefings. One story I really remember is that we were sitting in a briefing room in Townsville, and a guy from Canberra came, and he was a civilian, and he showed us a photograph of the city of Dili. And that photograph then turned sideways and turned into a 3D photograph, and he started driving us through the streets of Dili, showing us what to expect when we left the airport, going towards a fountain, hanging a left at the first road at this roundabout, going over a bridge, you know. And it was amazing because I was one of the first soldiers to go from the airport to the city. And I remember that going through my head. I said, this is just what that guy showed us in Townsville. For us, what I remember is that we knew the militia was armed with rudimentary weapons, so we weren't too afraid of those. We also knew that the Indonesians were backing these militias, so it was kind of confusing. It was a bit of limbo as to which way are they going to go. I mean, certainly if the Indonesian or the TNI would have acted in strength against us, you know, it could have gotten very messy, especially considering we didn't have artillery with us.
I suppose INTERFET were hoping they wouldn't have to deal with the Indonesian military or the regular Indonesian military.
I'm certain that we wouldn't have gone in there had the highest powers, and we're talking like General Cosgrove level, Prime Minister and Cabinet level, obviously had the confidence that the chances of us coming into real danger through in conflict with the Indonesian army was very minimal. So I think that's probably where they were coming from. For us, we saw what we saw on television, what people in Australia saw. We saw guys putting wigs on, you know, Kompassus, which is the Indonesian Special Forces people. We heard about them being involved in running these militias and doing these things.
Some documents have emerged of some planning by other forces.
Yes, which, when translated, turned out to be a set of orders, the so-called Gennady document, a set of orders to be given in the event of the referendum failing. Plan B would be to destroy all important facilities, and it does look pretty much as if this is the plan that was followed, because the violence was not totally random. It was targeted at known leaders of the CNRT and also infrastructure and facilities. All the phone system was completely destroyed, all the public phones, of which there were many then. Schools, hospitals, healthcare, almost everything the Indonesians had spent their money on to try and make the Timorese like them, if you like, was destroyed or was attempted to be destroyed in that particular violence.
Where did this document come from?
Well, it does seem that it was written by somebody at the highest levels of the Indonesian military.
I was there on with the very first wave of aircraft, and we flew out of Townsville. A lot of people think we came from Darwin, but we actually flew directly from Townsville. And that night, before we left, we were at the 2nd Battalion headquarters, that's 2 RAR, And the guy who was commanding that battalion is now Brigadier Slater, who's running the show in East Timor at the moment. We boarded our C-130 Hercules aircraft. It was a pretty uncomfortable trip. We were talking, we didn't know what to expect. We didn't know, is it going to be marching bands that meet us? Could there be hostility when we get there? We just weren't sure. When the plane landed in Dili, the door came down and soldiers started filing out of the plane. So we had to secure two points of entry. The first one was the airport and the second one was the port. So I jumped on this truck and off we went. And I was, you know, sort of worried. I was thinking anything could happen here. Looking back, I don't think I had any reason to be worried. But, you know, you just don't know. It's strange. You're excited. We knew there was a big sense of history about this entire operation. So we got to the port. And I watched the New Zealand Army guys take the weapons off of guys. I started to see refugees. They slowly started to come up to me and very reluctantly started smiling and shaking our hands and kissing my hand. And some of them were crying. It was just amazing. There was a real sense of justice, I think, when we got there. Especially when we saw, you know, because we'd been watching for days, like the rest of the country, on the news, what was going on there. And to go in there with force and to be able to offer protection was just a fantastic feeling. You know, you can imagine... Indonesia felt that they invested a lot into the country, and here these people didn't want them. It's sort of like I've spent all my adult life in Australia. Whenever I go back to America, people say, why does everybody hate us? Why does everybody hate America? And the Indonesians, I think, are sort of like that. Why do these people hate us, you know? Mm. And they just couldn't seem to understand that. Why? That, you know, people want to be independent. They don't want to be told what to do by others.
Was the success of INTERFET still a great victory for the Defence Forces?
Yeah. We had that feeling when we left. I think Australian soldiers are always told we're the best in the world. Things like that. Having been a U.S. Marine, you know, they're told the same thing. And I'm sure other countries are told the same thing as well. So they're beefed up with all that feeling and then a lot of hype. They knew and wanted to do a really good job. It was a really popular cause, so we were lucky to have the support of the people on board. And that's from almost every section of the population. We had that support. So we went in there with a really good feeling. I still have a good feeling about it. I've stayed involved with East Timor issues, with East Timorese people. It's, you know, very much the highlight of my life, my professional life, and something I look forward to continuing with.
Would the East Timorese consider INTERFET a success the same way Australia would?
Many people have established links with East Timor, and even I've noticed many former soldiers who were in INTERFET have left the army and gone back to Timor in some civilian capacity to, you know, do some humanitarian work or other. And it's unlike an attitude towards any other country in our region, I think, not even Papua New Guinea, which was our own colony, and we should have had a much closer relationship positively with PNG over the years, I think. But it does create a bit of an attitude as if because we sent in we, and, you know, and people use the word we, even though INTERFET was an international force, sent in troops to help the Timorese in their hour of need, that we can somehow decide what they do, what policies they introduce, what language they speak even, so that there is a bit of proprietorial attitude that unfortunately has been a spin-off of the successful INTERFET process.